they didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She's an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
Mr. Red Man, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and or lease non-renewal notices. The phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll speak with writer and journalist Timothy Faust about his new book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Then we'll continue our coverage of healthcare in America with Jennifer Block, also a journalist, whose book is called Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The movement for a single-payer healthcare system in the U.S. has been organizing for years, But only in the past couple of years has it gained steam after relentless Republican attacks on Obamacare. A majority of House Democrats have now signed on to a bill that would establish a Medicare for All system in the U.S., but skepticism still abounds, even within the Democratic Party. Critics consistently insist that a Medicare for All system would cost too much without taking into account all the costs, including profits, that the current system eats up. At this critical moment in the fight for healthcare for all Americans, we turn to a timely book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Its author is Timothy Faust, a writer and journalist with expertise in the healthcare system and the single payer system in particular. He's written for Splinter News, Jacobin, and Vice, and now joins me. Welcome, Tim.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So let's first clarify some terms. We hear the word single payer usually conflated with Medicare for All. Your book subtitle has the word single payer in it. What is the difference between these terms? And what does single payer even mean? It sounds like a little bit of a wonky term.
Sure. So single payer and Medicare for All, at least in the U.S., refer to the same thing. Medicare for All, this happens to pull a little bit better, so people tend to use that term. What single payer is single payer is a healthcare finance model in which everybody's healthcare needs, whether they're medical, dental, vision, or long-term care for folks with disabilities, are covered in full by the federal single payer without any like co-pays or costs to use at the point of service. So right now, if I want to go to the doctor, I need to have insurance because medical costs are just way higher than what I can afford on my own. So if I need to have insurance, I got to pay premiums, couple hundred bucks, $500 every month, and then I gotta find a doctor. I gotta find a doctor who's in network, who contracts with my insurance company. I gotta go to the doctor, I gotta pay a copay for the office visit, then I gotta pay whatever my insurance company bills me at the end of the visit, and then I gotta pay whatever the doctor bills me on top of that after the insurance bills me. Under a single payer model, if I gotta go to the doctor, I just find any doctor who's around, who I want to go see, I go see the doctor, I get the healthcare I need, and then I leave. It's free to use at the point of service. There's no costs attached to it. It's a much more humane and easier to use model.
It's certainly elegant. And if you listened to the Democratic debates that took place in early August, the detractors of Medicare for All who wanted to strengthen the Affordable Care Act had a much harder time explaining the ins and outs and intricacies of that system. But on the Medicare for All system, their single point of attack seem to be, it's going to cost too much, it's pie in the sky, it's fantasy land. The cost is what we always hear. That's a red herring, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out. How do you explain that in your book about cost? And if, should we even worry about something that, you know, our actual healthcare depends on? I mean, even talking about cost seems a little strange about something that's so critical for so many, for all Americans.
Sure. You've got a couple of things there. I'm going to go through a couple of them. Unit costs, overall costs, and then like how spending should be done in general. First of all, unit costs. How much a particular item of healthcare costs, whether it's a Band-Aid or a knee surgery or some other kind of procedure. Those in the U.S. are astronomically high, and they have been made high because we have a really weak multi-payer model in which there's no strong force pulling costs down. There's no cost regulation. The average inpatient procedure in the U.S. costs 40% more than the exact same procedure performed on the exact same patient when performed in France. You've got MRIs, which cost five times more, the same machine doing the same exact scan when performed in Australia. All these unit costs are astronomical. What a single payer can do is bring these costs down by acting as a de facto price setter. A single payer says, hey, we negotiate on behalf of 330 million people. We're willing to pay $1 for every Band-Aid. So either take our price or leave it. And virtually every hospital takes it because they don't want to miss out on that big pool of customers. So that's unit costs. Single payer is much more equipped than like our current private model to handle these things. Private models are just too small and too weak, and they can't negotiate with hospitals or other doctors. That's why Aetna, for example, pays between three and five times what Medicare pays for a given medical procedure. Then you've got total medical costs. It's called NHE, National Healthcare Expenditures. Right now, we spend $3.5 trillion on NHE, and we get some of the worst outcomes of any country that spends similarly. We're the worst first world country as far as like what our return is on our healthcare spend. It's projected that a single payer, because it can reduce costs, would actually only need to spend $2.9 trillion in NHE. It's actually a cost-saving measure. And we can, right now, two-thirds of that $2.9 trillion could be funded through what we currently spend on Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, all these programs combined. And the other third would come from things like payroll taxes, wealth taxes, financial derivative taxes, wherever you want to tax folks from. And so what that means is that we just take all the money you're currently spending on premiums, co-pays, deductibles, your share of the insurance that your employer sponsors, all these things that add up, and instead of giving you one blanket tax sum, and it ends up being much smaller than the big pile of things you accumulated in the first place. I think the Sanders plan projects that a family of four making $40,000 a year would go from $5,600 in annual healthcare expenditures to $400 under a single payer plan. So the costs are really, we're not building a new healthcare model on top of the one we already have. We're just reallocating the money we currently spend to make things more efficient and take care of everybody, which is really a crucial part of the process. Then as far as like what should we spend, I mean, personally, frankly, I think we should spend whatever it takes to make sure our people are healthy and have what they need, right? Healthcare spending is very high return. You compare it to warfare spending or arms spending, in which every dollar you spend, you get 80 cents back. I think with healthcare spending, it's like in the 4 to 7 range. You put $1 in, you get $4 to $7 back. But there's a lot of jobs, a lot of work, a lot of like transfer and value being created in healthcare markets. Personally, I don't think that, like, we got to spend our money somewhere, and I don't think spending on healthcare is a bad idea. Actually, one of the points of the book that I want to touch on is the idea that healthcare is a thing that happens beyond just the operating table, right, in the hospital. And so once a single payer is forced to bear all the costs of providing care, but also bear all the risks and costs of what happens when care is not provided, like, for example, if you live in unsafe housing conditions and there's mold in the walls, or it's flammable, or you don't have any housing at all, you're going to get much sicker much more often than you would from, for example, stage 4 cancer, right? You die from exposure way faster than you die from cancer. That's a really expensive cost. And right now, nobody really bears that cost. Sometimes hospitals do, but nobody really bears the cost of what happens when people have unsafe housing or not enough
food. So sort of public health issues.
Right, totally. Nobody really suffers. Nobody's bottom line is really impacted by public health issues. Maybe Medicaid, and they build things like housing programs. But a single payer has the size, the weight, and the resources to really invest, I think, in programs beyond just hospital.
One of the comebacks to the issue of Medicare or Medicare for All system being able to drive down costs overall is you have critics saying hospitals are just going to shut down. Doctors will, you know, find other vocations because a Medicare for All system would drive costs down too much. What do you make of that?
I don't think that's accurate, right? Right now, hospitals have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money dealing with the fact that a large portion of their customer base could be uninsured. They've got massive billing departments. I think it's 50% of a doctor's time in a week is spent dealing with billing. 60% of nurses' times are spent arguing with other nurses at insurance companies about how much they got to bill. All that is wiped out. You've got way more productive hours you can spend in the day. Also, everybody who comes to your hospital is insured. You're guaranteed to get paid for everybody who walks in the door, and you know at what prices and what costs. It provides hospitals a stable business model instead of this massive secondary industry of trying to gouge private insurers and spend all this time going back and forth and being combative. As far as doctors, what I think I'm really interested in is med students. I think right now, med students go to med school and they accumulate $200,000, $300,000 in debt, then go out into the job market, and the jobs that look most appealing are, you know, being a hand surgeon, being a plastic surgeon, being a high-paid cardiologist. And so the kinds of doctors we need, primary care providers, GPs, family practitioners. So I think a secondary program or like a secondary initiative or secondary fight for the fight for single payer is the fight to make medical training, whether it's med school, nurse training, home health, vocational training, free or offer really generous reimbursement programs. That's the way you make sure you have enough doctors by driving down the cost of going to school to keep a program going.
Let's talk about that broader framework that you discuss in your book. Your book is called Health Justice Now. That's not a term we use often enough when talking about the issue of healthcare. What do you mean by health justice?
Sure. There's just your health is not a thing that just happens like in a hospital, like I said, right? Your health is impacted on, do you have housing? Do you have food? Do you experience racism? Do you experience sexism? Do you experience poverty? Do you experience exploitation by your boss? Do you not have a job in the first place? All these things affect how your health manifests. And so to really assess health or healthcare or how we approach health as a society, there is this big, I'd say, intersectional, interlocking approach that we got to consider all at the same time, right? If your people are suffering because they don't have access to housing, whatever, then housing is healthcare. If your people are suffering because they don't have access to food, so they get diabetes or comorbidities like cardiac failure, then food is healthcare. Needle exchange programs are healthcare. Rehab is healthcare. Transportation is healthcare. If you're a dialysis patient living in a rural area, you can't get to the dialysis center in time. You lose your spot in the line to get an organ transplant. Transportation is healthcare. All these things have fundamental roles in how you experience health. We understand that, for example, black men receive worse heart health care than white men. Black women experience 3 times the rate of maternal mortality than white women. And so you could conclude from that like race affects health, but that's not true, right? No, black people aren't born differently than white people and have worse health conditions. They just, racism is the driving factor. Racism affects one's ability to receive health, along with structural poverty and structural sexism. And these things can't be untangled by just insurance, right? Insurance is not enough to really untangle all these problems that weave together. So I think a broader idea of health equity, of health justice, lets us kind of tease apart the different things that affect our health and joust towards them all at once. Mm-hmm. And just because insurance can't solve the problems of structural racism does not mean single payer is inadequate to the task. Because single payer, I think, is the only thing that's even possible to really confront these problems, these obstacles. All these problems are exacerbated by a for-profit, multi-payer model that restricts your access to care, so a hospital CEO or an insurance CEO can get paid $2 million a year. I mean, they're really like, they've got their hands in the pot making these conditions worse. I think only a single payer that is, again, forced to bear the costs of the consequences for these problems can begin to tilt against them.
So if we are at a stage now where the fight for single payer has ratcheted up, do you feel that the current Medicare for All bill introduced in the House by Pramila Jayapal, in the Senate by Bernie Sanders, adequately meets what you would consider a single payer system that, you know, could eventually encompass these other public health issues as well? Or is this just a first step?
Yeah, well, they're always the first step, but I think Jayapal's was the first battle-ready single-payer bill. Mm. I've got a couple of components a single bill has to include. It's got to have one mandatory, like, pool of all people, like everybody in, nobody out. It's got to offer comprehensive care, medical, dental, vision, and really importantly, long-term care for folks with disabilities. That's where Sanders was weak until he fixed it, I think, in March or April of this year. It's got to have federal funding, federal standards, federal oversight, but I think local implementation. Healthcare in Boston and healthcare in California and healthcare in Ohio, healthcare in Boise are all different from each other. And you want to have local agencies kind of controlling their own disbursement of dollars, meeting the federal standards. Jayapal's bill has room for that. And lastly, it's got to have budgetary tools so it can kind of muck around with new payment models, things like global budgeting for hospitals, just general tools that are essential to keep costs where they need to be. Jayapal's bill has all of that. Sanders' bill was a little bit weaker, but he came around on long-term care, I think, after Jayapal's bill really set the bar. He doesn't have all the budgetary tools, but they're pretty strong. They can be reconciled after they're passed. But yeah, these are finally, I think, the first like bills that really can be put into the fire and examined and fought for.
What led to this moment? I mentioned that the attacks on the Affordable Care Act by Republicans, in a way, inadvertently seemed to create an opening for single-payer advocates and also kind of expose the internal battle that went all the way back to 2018 between advocates of those who want to see a private health insurance system remain in place and flourish and those who would like to see health insurance companies be taken out of the mix altogether. So now you have establishment Democrats scrambling to save the ACA. You have single-payer advocates pushing for single-payer. And you have Republicans claiming they have some as yet to be determined health care bill that would be better than everything else, but not actually coming forward. What led to this place and how do we move the needle towards single payer?
Sure. So I think one of the reasons that the ACA was passed in 2012, 2013, There was not a lot of advocacy for it from the White House, right? Obama passed it, then kind of walked away because it was politically vulnerable. Really, the first person to really create a lot of advocacy for the ACA was Paul Ryan by attacking it, and by attacking measures like protections for pre-existing conditions that people found were really important. I think the reason single payer is on the rise now is because costs are skyrocketing. Like, it's at a point where I think the average American family can't afford a $400 medical procedure, but premiums are already higher than that. The crisis is imminent, right? The crisis is in all of our bodies. We all understand that we are just one, you know, a wrong turn of the steering wheel, one fluke ion from microwave. We're all one freak accident away from drowning in catastrophic medical debt. And I think we all are leaving our kids behind or seeing our kids get sick. And I think we all understand that pretty intuitively, pretty inherently. The ACA has really failed to make things better for a lot of people. It's done a lot, especially the expansion of Medicaid, but it hasn't done enough. It kind of believes that you can take the things that are breaking the model, which is private insurance companies, and somehow make them play nice and make things line up. But that never works. And all these things like Biden Care, Medicare Advantage for All, Healthcare for America, whatever plan.
Kamala Harris's plan that she calls Medicare for All, but isn't really.
Right. They're all trying to take these broken toys that have caused these problems, these private insurance companies, and get them in line. It's like adding rungs to a ladder when you're drowning in quicksand. It doesn't do anything. It's meaningless. You're sacrificing the power and the ability and the financial backing and the general humanity of what a single payer can do to just keep private insurance companies profitable. That's really all it is. They don't want Aetna and Blue Cross to close or get mad. They don't want to step on anybody's toes. So they're offering these really milquetoast half ideas. And those aren't interesting. Those don't speak to me, at least. Those don't recognize the dignity or humanity of people and give them what they need. And I think people really respond well to universal programs. If you give somebody something, they're going to fight to keep it, and they'll want to get on to the next thing and fight to keep that. People generally like Medicare. People generally like having Medicaid. I think these universal programs are simpler to understand, don't have massive carve-outs for private companies, and really address the core problem face-to-face instead of kind of dodging and hiding behind obscure policy bills.
And it seems as though the Republican approach to healthcare has been to just whip up anti-immigrant sentiment in their base. Their base, who would benefit directly from a single-payer bill, is simply angry about the fact that, there are arguments around whether immigrants would come into our country for the free healthcare funded by our tax dollars instead of just focusing on the actual issue at hand, right?
I mean, the Republican plan for healthcare is Mad Max's Thunderdome. It is nothing. It offers nobody anything. It's punitive. It's harsh. It's regressive. It actively destroys, if not hunts down, people who have disabilities, people who are sick, people who are poor, people who are hungry. And yes, it's wildly, like, a lot of their rhetoric is wildly xenophobic. I believe a single payer has to include healthcare for everybody in the country, including non-documented citizens. Right.
Right. I mean, if you or I go to Canada today and get sick or have an injury, whether we're Canadian citizens or not, that healthcare system funded by Canadian taxpayers will serve you and will not bill you.
Right. I mean, one, it's the right thing to do, obviously. Everybody is a human being who deserves to be safe in their own bodies. But if you want to get pragmatic, there is a massive quantity of wealth being built off the backs of the labor of undocumented immigrants, right? They're contributing in a massive way to our GDP and the pockets of wealthier people who are using their labor. It is only the just thing to do to return upon them and other people who visit the U.S. Healthcare that they're helping pay for in the first place.
It's amazing that we don't stop to think about some of the built-in assumptions into our current system that just rarely get questioned, which is, why are employers involved in the administration of health insurance? I mean, it's sort of a weird thing that you would get your health benefits through the job that you are in if you're not over the age of 65, and a single payer system would not only free employers from having to provide health insurance, free up unions from having one less battle to deal with, it would also free up employees and to being able to take whatever job they wanted, because it would suddenly not be tied to benefits.
Right. I mean, the relationship between employers, employees, and insurance is an accident of history, right? It's a relic from World War II. When employers could get tax benefits, they could get around wage freezes by offering insurance to their employees, for making the jobs that they were offering more attractive. And it got to stay in place after World War II. But that's like an accident of history, things merging at the wrong time. It's not like any kind of like way that insurance has to work. And actually, it has really deleterious consequences. I like that you brought up the example of unions, right? Unions have pretty good to great health insurance, but that it's still cost increases for that insurance every single year. And the time and money and power they spend fighting for that insurance comes at the expense of money they could be spending fighting for better wages, workplace safety, and better conditions. So I think, yeah, this is I think a great emancipator, right? Right now, if your employer is a jerk, he or she controls your access to things like blood transfusion, hormone therapy, contraception, all these things are within the purview of your employer to decide for you. If you have an abusive employer or if you have an abusive domestic partner from whom you get insurance, they have power over the health care you get and the health care your kids get. And that's buck wild to me. That is totally insane. That is a kind of employer domination that you don't see elsewhere in other countries. Mm-hmm. And so single payer does a lot to help folks kind of walk away from these exploitative relationships and have the freedom to organize, freedom to protest, freedom to do things they can't do now because they're afraid of losing their job. Like, for example, I just got employer-sponsored insurance at the beginning of this year, and it's amazing. Now I only got to spend $220 a week instead of $500 to see the doctors that I got to see. Which is still a lot of money to spend, and I could barely afford it. But now I'm really afraid of losing my job or walking out or getting fired because I can't afford to not see a doctor, but I also can't afford to see a doctor if I don't have insurance.
Right. Yeah. So many of these issues that just don't sadly enter the national conversation when discussions around single payer come up, which is why, of course, you've written a book about it that people could certainly read. You write in your book about the pharmaceutical industry, and I'd love to just focus on that for a bit, because this is a sort of a different set of companies, and the issue around drug prices is also a very, very big part of the conversation. You know, Bernie Sanders in a high profile insulin caravan took a bunch of type 1 diabetes patients across the border so they could buy cheaper insulin. And now Canadians are upset because they think that Americans shouldn't be taking advantage of the low prices that they negotiate. And the U.S. could certainly negotiate those low prices themselves, but they seem so beholden to the pharmaceutical industry. Should we be including conversations around the pharmaceutical industry as we do about the health insurance industry in these conversations around health justice?
Absolutely. I think one thing we should begin exploring is the public manufacturing of generic drugs, right? If we produce things domestically for domestic use, we can do a lot to really drive down medical costs, pharmaceutical costs. Drug companies never play nice, and there's three actors in the reason why drug prices are very high. It's pharma companies, it's insurance companies, and it's a third group of companies called pharmacy benefit manufacturers, PBMs. And the three of them together get into this like tripartite antagonistic dance in which the results are just skyrocketing drug costs year over year over year. And because they all benefit in different ways, or at any given point in time, two of them are benefiting, things aren't going to change. I think taking steps to bring to realize that a lot of drug research is done by public entities, by underpaid or unpaid grad students, and their work is then bundled and sold to for-profit pharma companies, and taking that work back and producing drugs domestically, publicly, I think is a really, really good first step to taking on pharma kind of more face-to-face, more full throttle.
Finally, Timothy, I just want to kind of address the broad framework around how our healthcare system is so tied into a profit-making system currently. Any talk about single-payer healthcare immediately elicits accusations of socialists from Republicans who seem to think that that's a good line of attack, and then that gets some of the establishment Democrats into these defensive postures. But I mean, maybe we should come out and explicitly say that capitalism does not belong in conversations around healthcare, and socialism is the way to go when we're talking about healthcare. Because it's the way we've decided pension plans for seniors, you know, called Social Security works well, or the Veterans Administration, or the current Medicare system. I mean, should we sort of call out the fact that capitalism has created the monster we're in today, and a socialist system could actually be a good solution?
Absolutely. I think we've given market capitalism 60 years to solve these problems, and they've made the problems much worse. Right now, if you're the wrong kind of person or you got the wrong kind of sickness, you're just thrown out in the street. You're taxed, or you're billed to death, and then your children inherit those bills and pass them forward. People are dying because they don't have access to medical care, so they go to the hospital too late and they get too sick, and there's complications. We do all these things to exploit and confuse and hurt people because they're not profitable. And the people that are remain who are profitable are insured until they become a problem, and then they're kicked off their insurance plans. They're coerced into leaving their insurance plans or can't afford to stay on their insurance plans and go on to public health care. We're already subsidizing private industry to an incredible degree by taking the sickest people and the most vulnerable people and insuring them with tax dollars. Why not use that money to insure all of us in the first place? Because the private market has done nothing good in the past 50 years.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I think it's a good book, and I hope people like it.
My guest has been Timothy Faust, writer and journalist with expertise in healthcare and a single-payer system. He's written for Splinter News, Jacobin, and Vice. We've been discussing his new book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. Thank you.